This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Fighting the COVID-19 pandemic has brought our global debt total to an all-time high of $281 trillion at the end of 2020. But how can the whole world be in debt? Who exactly is the planet in debt to? I mean, Martians? Top secret bank run by goblins? I'm Dashran Johan and this is Today I Learned. On the show with me today is Geoffrey Williams, an economist at the Malaysia University of Science and Technology. So, Geoffrey, when I think of debt, it's very simple. If I borrow money from a friend, I owe a debt to him. One is the borrower and the other is the lender. But how can our world be in debt? Because it sounds to me, like I mentioned in the intro, like there's a secret bank in the galaxy far, far away that all our world leaders are borrowing money from. I mean, how do we even begin talking about this?
Okay, well, the truth is, actually, when we think about global debt, it is almost as simple as borrowing money from your friend. So the money is going just from one group of people to another group of people. The type of people who are borrowing are like you and me, households and normal consumers. Then, of course, businesses borrow, and then governments borrow. And they borrow, obviously, in different amounts and for different reasons. But we are the type of guys who are borrowing the money, and the people who are lending it are actually the same type of people. Ordinary household, ordinary people, ordinary members of households, they will lend money or put the money into their bank. Sometimes they will buy bonds, government securities directly. And that's a form of lending. So ordinary households will lend. And of course, the banks will have our deposits when we put money into our current and savings accounts, and then they will use that money. Part of it, they keep it. That's called a deposit ratio. But they keep that for normal day-to-day transactions. The balance, they lend it to people. And they lend it to governments by buying government bonds. They lend it to companies by giving them business loans. They lend it to you and me through our credit cards or whatever it is, an overdraft or a personal loan. And so all of these guys are lending and borrowing at the same time.
Okay, you mentioned a lot of terms. You say it's very simple. But again, like I think for a lot of us, there is this confusion that when we talk about global debt, to a lot of us, it seems like the whole world as an entity is borrowing money from someone. So let's break it all down. So we take a step back. Before talking about global debt, let's talk about national debt. What exactly is national debt?
Okay, national debt is the amount of borrowing that takes place within an individual country as a whole. And it's primarily the government and public sector debt. But there are different components to that because there is the government debt, the sovereign debt, and then that would be like the federal government debt. And then there is additional borrowing, and this additional borrowing could be from state governments, for example. It can be from government agencies, or it could be from GLCs and so on. They're all government related, and they're borrowing. But that's not on the government's balance sheet. It's off balance sheet debt. Sometimes we call some of these debts contingent liabilities. And you'll remember under the previous government, they were very concerned about these contingent liabilities. These are debts which are taken out by organizations which are sort of related to the government, but they're not necessarily government entities. But if they were to default on those debts, then the government would be responsible for it. Government would have to repay it. So the public debt or the sovereign debt is the debt that is owed by the federal government. Then the national debt is debt that's owed by the federal government and then the state governments and then all of it related.
And why does a country or a government, or you mentioned GLCs and all that, why do they borrow money which then adds to the national debt? And who do they usually borrow from?
In different countries, the lenders are different entities. All right. But let's just go back to answer the question, why do they do it in the first place? Well, why they do it is because they don't have enough money to fulfill their plans. Now, if they're a government or they're a GLC, then these are mainly investment plans. But for the government, they can also be direct consumption plans. You know, the government has a budget. It needs to spend on schools and hospitals and salaries and civil servants and all of these sort of things. And it will get its revenue primarily from taxes, or in Malaysia, it also gets an oil royalty from Petronas. So it can get its revenue from various sources. But if the revenue isn't sufficient to cover the costs of what it wants to spend on, it has a deficit. And so it has to borrow that money. And then the same would be true of a company. If it's a big company as like a GLC, they will have investment plans and they don't have sufficient revenue to pay for those investments, because the investments are normally very expensive and they're very they're one-off. And so they will have a revenue stream over time that would pay for it, but they don't have it just at that moment. They borrow the money in order to make the investment. Now, the hope is that they would use the money wisely, they would invest it properly, and then that would deliver growth in the long term. And then if the business is growing, or in the case of the government, if they invest the money properly and the economy is growing, then they will be able to repay the debt over a longer period. That's basically how the debt will accumulate over time.
Okay, so just to paint a picture, basically it all boils down to this. Every year, for example, in Malaysia, we have the annual budget where they vote on it in parliament and whatnot. And let's say if the government says they want to spend $300 billion on whatever plans they have for the following year. And if they do not have enough, then they borrow from other entities, which can include countries. Am I right?
Yes, it can. But in Malaysia, most of the government's borrowing comes from other Malaysians.
Right.
The majority of government borrowing comes from Malaysian households, Malaysian financial entities and non-financial companies who will buy the government bond domestically.
Right.
There is a small amount of foreign borrowing for the federal government, but it's relatively small. For the private sector, it's the other way around, because for the private sector in Malaysia, a great deal of the borrowing is from overseas. It's from foreign banks and foreign companies. But for the government, actually, it's very domestically oriented. And that's often why the government tells us that they have a limit, they have a constraint.
Right.
On how they can borrow, because they have a specific policy, which is a good policy, it's strategically quite important, that they prefer to raise the money for government debt on the domestic market rather than on the international market.
Okay. So now let's tie that back to the bigger picture that we are exploring today, global debt. So how is global debt different from national debt?
All right, because global debt is a combination of four components.
Okay.
The first is the sovereign debt or the government debt of each of the countries. The second is the financial debt of banks and other financial entities. The third is the debt from companies which are not financial companies, but are non-financial companies, construction companies and things like that, manufacturing companies and so on. And then the fourth element is household debt, personal consumer debt. But that can also include things such as mortgage debt, for example, depending on which country you're in. Mm. So global debt is the combination of all four of those components. Mm.
All right, let's head out for a very short break. I'm speaking with Geoffrey Williams, an economist at the Malaysia University of Science and Technology on Today I Learned, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Today I Learned. I'm Dashran Johan, and with me on Zoom is Geoffrey Williams, an economist at the Malaysia University of Science and Technology, and we are talking about global debt. What does it actually mean when we say our whole world is in debt? Now, Geoffrey, which countries in the world have the most debt?
Well, the way that we normally answer that is, first you can say, well, how much debt do they have in dollar terms?
Yes.
You know, the actual amount of debt. But that's really not very helpful, because we need to look at that in terms of the size of the economy as a whole. So we generally will look at the ratio of debt to GDP. And mostly the thing that we're most concerned about is government debt or public debt to GDP. So the countries which have the highest public debt to GDP, the top one is Japan. It's mm-hmm. more than 200%. It's 223%, actually. And it's been like that for a long time. Gross government debt in Japan is 263%. That means it's more than 2.5 times the gross domestic product. Then you get countries like the Sudan and Greece, and then Italy, Lebanon, and then the United States is also a very big debtor in terms of gross government debt, but not so much in terms of gross public debt. But actually, some which are quite surprising, for example, Singapore, our neighbor down south. I mean, Singapore has a ratio of gross public debt, which is greater than 100% of GDP. And at the moment, it has a ratio of gross government debt, which is 132% of GDP.
Okay.
So it's not always the developing economies, the poor economies. It's not always the economies which are characterized as having unstable governments or economic difficulties of one form or another. That's not always the reason why countries have a high debt to GDP ratio.
And that's what I'm very curious about. How can a country, because you mentioned countries like Japan, Singapore, how can a country be doing well economically but still be so heavy in debt?
Because it very much depends upon what the money was used for.
Okay.
And this is the root of the economic argument as to whether public debt or government debt in particular, whether it's a good thing or a bad thing.
Mm.
Because various economists who come from what's often called the Keynesian tradition, they are of the view that actually it's not so big a problem for us to have a high debt level, even a debt level which is greater than GDP.
Okay.
Provided the borrowing is being used for development purposes. If you, for example, you borrow quite a lot of money, but you invest it in education and research and development and even social infrastructure like hospitals and schools and this sort of thing, this actually helps your economy to grow mm-hmm. in the long term. And then because the economy is growing, if the rate of growth of the economy is greater than the amount of repayment of the debt, you're in a good, we call it a virtuous cycle, virtuous circle. And you're in a good position because you've used the debt for the right reason. But if you've taken on a great deal of debt and then you've wasted it, sometimes, you know, governments take on debt. They don't use it for investment purposes. They use it for day-to-day consumption purposes.
Right.
And so the debt is taken on and then it's spent in the economy. They would hope that that would cause the economy to grow, but it doesn't necessarily cause the economy to grow in the long run because it's a consumption process. It's not an investment process. And what that means is that they don't get the growth in the long run. And so the economy is not growing enough for them to cover the repayments. Then it becomes problematic in the long run. And of course, there are still other countries in which the government take on the debt and they steal it. Corruption and all manner of nefarious activities. We call this odious debt. It is that there is actually a real economic and legal term for it. It's called odious debt.
Right.
And in these circumstances where you can demonstrate that the government took out the debt and then they squandered it or they stole it because of corruption, then there is a claim as to whether you should have to repay it or not.
Mm.
And in many countries, for example, particularly in Africa, have taken the view that their government has taken on a lot of debt and then the government was a terrible government and it was overthrown. And then here they are left with this massive debt burden. And then the people really have no chance of paying it back because it's too large and the economy is not growing and it wasn't used for investment and infrastructural development. And that has led to the idea of a debt forgiveness in global terms, where you can look at a country and you can say, all right, you really have no chance of repaying this. And actually, it wasn't your fault. And it makes no sense for us to constantly ask you to give up a big chunk of your income every year to pay on this debt. So under certain circumstances, we will forgive it. We will forgive the debt. And who is it that forgives the debt?
Yes.
Well, it's like the World Bank, for example, the international financial institutions who lent the debt in the first place. And it's the big countries who are involved in those institutions, the United States, European Union countries, Japan, Australia and New Zealand, Canada, all of these sort of places. And they will say, well, there are special circumstances under which we will forgive the debt. And that's a perfectly rational way to understand how the debt can be managed for countries which are really being crushed.
Mm.
No chance of paying it off. So debt forgiveness is actually a really important component of understanding the whole debt issue. And it doesn't just extend to countries. It actually extends to individuals as well.
Right.
You know, the idea that sometimes people get themselves into such a heavy burden of debt that there's no chance that they will be able to repay it.
Mm.
And then there is a moral issue why you should do that, for sure. And most of the main religions teach us about debt forgiveness as a moral, it's morally right to do that. But it's also economically right in many instances, because if you're massively overburdened with debt, you're never going to be able to make the investments to get out. So that's a very important issue, which is often overlooked, I think, when people are talking about debt, because there's always this idea that, well, you took out the debt, you have to repay it. It's your moral duty. And this is rubbish, frankly, mm-hmm. utter nonsense. We have to bear that in mind, because otherwise we get ourselves into a position where people will constantly be crushed by debt. Countries also.
Which are the world's biggest lenders?
The world's biggest lender at the moment is China. And this is, of course, this has changed over time, because historically it would have been the United States and Europe, for no other reason than they are the biggest economies. But now China has overtaken as the world's biggest lender. And what's interesting about the path of Chinese lending is that it's mostly coming from the Chinese government. And it's all part of the Belt and Road type initiatives, where they are using the possibility of debt to help countries who wouldn't get access to debt from the sort of traditional sources, the World Bank, for example, or private financial institutions.
Exactly. And that's, I was doing some reading when I was preparing for this interview. One fascinating thing I came across is how for many, many years, if you look back in recent history, for example, the big giants, the superpowered economies of the world, they really lend to developing, struggling countries and things like that. Whereas China has sort of filled that void and has taken up that role for itself. Can you sort of put things into perspective? What is the sort of debates happening among economies in this regard?
Well, historically, the financial institutions like the World Bank have lent quite a lot of money to developing economies.
Okay.
Historically, if you go back 30, 40 years into it. But the experience hasn't been particularly positive.
Right.
So, I mean, we've had about, since the 1970s, we've had four main periods of debt accumulation. And the early ones from about 1970 to 1990, that sort of 20-year period, this was largely driven by what you've just been mentioning, which is global financial institutions like the World Bank, for example, lending money, in that case, particularly to Latin America, but not only Latin America. And it was supposed to be for investment purposes.
Right.
Like we mentioned before, but mm-hmm. for one reason or another, it wasn't used for investment purposes. And then it ballooned, this debt. I mean, it went up 10 times over a course of 20 years or so. And then, because it wasn't being used for investment purposes, these economies fell into economic problems. Particularly, they fell into hyperinflation problems. And they weren't able to repay the debt. And so they started to default on the debt. Particularly Mexico was the first to default. And then there was a sort of domino effect. When one country defaults, the other defaults, the other defaults, the other. And so that experience wasn't particularly successful during that first phase of debt accumulation. Then, after that, during the 1990s, but a sort of 10-year period during the 1990s, there was a second period of debt accumulation. But rather than coming from the global financial institutions like World Bank, it was coming through private financial companies. And this led, unfortunately, to something we know about here in Asia, particularly in Malaysia. This led to the financial crisis, the Asian financial crisis, because a lot of that debt turned into what were called non-performing loans.
Right.
And it was private sector, not necessarily government sector. And then when you have these non-performing loans, people were not able to repay the debt, they started to default, or there's a risk of default, and then you have a financial crisis. And that was a private sector driven. And then after that, during the period from about 2000 to 2009, there was a second period of debt accumulation, and this focused mainly in the United States and Europe.
Right.
Again, this was private sector largely. So now we're in a different phase where these global financial institutions lending to governments are doing it on very different terms. The private sector have been bitten twice, if you like, from the Asia crisis and then the 2008 crisis, which led to what we call the Great Recession. And this void, as you quite rightly said, is being filled by China, because China has money. And it's coming from the Chinese government. And the Chinese government can print the money. You know, is it coming from, you know, aliens or something? It's not coming. It's coming from governments. And at the moment, it's coming from the Chinese government, not aliens. But basically, they have the right to print money, that they have monopoly right to print money. So they can print the money. Their economy is also booming as well. So they already have money from different sources as well. And then they make a strategic decision, a political decision. Should they invest it in China, or should they invest it in overseas infrastructural projects? Mm-hmm. And they've decided that through the Belt and Road, they want to extend China's reach through trade and investment. And there is, as you said, there is a void there. There is a vacuum there. And there are lots of developing countries that are very, very, very much in need of this, and they don't have access to it from the other financial and development agencies, international. And they don't have it either from the private sector either. So China's filling this gap. It's actually very large. I mean, China is responsible for 6%. The Chinese lending is 6% of global GDP.
Right.
And if you take the top 50 countries, the top 50 developing economies in the world, 15% of their GDP is in the form of debt to China.
Okay. And what happens if a country can't pay back its debt? What are the actions? I'm not talking about countries that, you know, are just completely, they cannot survive it anymore. And like you said, then the moral issue comes into play and things, debt forgiveness and all that. But generally, how do countries sort of tackle this issue of paying back its debts? What happens if they do not generate enough money within the economy to pay back the debt?
All right. Well, there are sort of various stages. The first is that they have to try to cut their own budget.
Okay.
Because the debt arises because they're spending more than they're earning. And so what they have to do is either to cut the spending, or they have to increase the taxes in order to try to balance that more effectively. And often we call this an austerity program. Right. When it gets quite tight, it becomes austerity. Before it gets very tight, we call it something much more, depending on your political perspective, but we call it fiscal conservatism.
Right.
It's just good housekeeping. Mm-hmm. And then if you're not able to make the savings, you have to cut deeper, tighten your belt more, and then that becomes austerity. If they're not able to fix it through that mechanism, they can print money. The central bank has the monopoly on printing money, so they just print more currency. That gives them the cash to pay the debt, but it also has the effect of reducing the value of the currency.
Right.
And if they can't do that, then they can go and ask for rescheduling of the loan, which is what the Greeks did during the Greek financial crisis. They went to the Europeans and asked for, you know, new loans and change the terms of the loans and this sort of thing. And if they can't do that, they default. And default means they just refuse to pay. And default is not particularly common, but it does happen from time to time. You know, even last year, there was a default in Lebanon. And 2001, there was a default in Argentina. 1998, there was a default in Russia. If you look through, you know, the many, many years of history, sovereign debt default is not unknown. Mm-hmm. And the real problem happens when it happens in many countries at the same time, as we had during, you know, this first wave that I mentioned in the Latin America wave, when many countries are defaulting, then that has a contagion effect on the global economy. And then that becomes a big problem. Yeah.
And another thing countries do in an effort to pay back the debt is also to borrow more money, this time from different sort of, let's say, if you're borrowing from the World Bank now, then perhaps you go to another country and borrow money. Can you talk to me a little bit about this?
Yes, because there are various sources where you can get the money from. You can get it from your own population, right? And your own population is basically, you know, guys in the street who want to buy a government bond is a good investment. You can use it for your pension. You can trade it. You know, it's an asset. So you can go to your own people, or you can go to your own companies, your own banks and your own financial institutions, or you can go to the non-bank sector where you have a manufacturing company, a car company, or power company, or something like that. They have surpluses, and then you ask them to help you with, you know, to lend you their surplus. So you can sort of do that domestically. If you can't get access to enough from your own population, then you have to go overseas. Mm. And then you have the same sort of options overseas. You have access to overseas households. You have access to overseas banks. You have access to overseas companies. You have access to overseas governments, like the Chinese government, or you have access to overseas development and finance organizations like the World Bank. And these are the places where you can go to get cash. And they will lend you on various terms. And if you're considered to be a good risk, you will get good terms. But if you're considered to be a bad risk, they might still lend the money to you. But of course, they're going to ask for a higher interest rate because you're a big risk. And that's going to be very costly because it means you have to pay that. And if you're paying, this is the problem for governments. If they're paying interest on loans, they can't use that money to spend on schools and hospitals and social infrastructure, right? Because they have to spend it on servicing debt. And that's when it becomes a real social problem as well as an economic problem, because the government's spending 25% of all of its income, giving it to foreign banks and agencies and so on. And that money could be spent on kids. And then that's when it becomes a problem.
Right. And is it a problem? Now, what was the figure I mentioned earlier? $281 trillion at the end of 2020. And a lot of it is because of the COVID-19 pandemic. Is it a problem that we have such high levels of global debt? Is there a limit? I mean, it sounds scary.
All right. There are some economists who will tell you that it isn't such a problem.
Okay.
And in fact, I've seen recently some Nobel laureates like Paul Krugman and people like that saying it's not a problem. Frankly, that's just rubbish. It's rubbish to say it's not a problem. It is a problem. But the argument that they give as to why it's not a problem is that they basically say that interest rates are very low at the moment, and they are, in fact, in many cases, because we have inflation and interest rates are very close to zero, real interest rates are actually negative. Mm-hmm. So they sort of say, well, interest rates are actually very low. So if the government takes out debt at the moment, it doesn't have to spend a lot of money servicing it. They also say, of course, because of the current COVID crisis, they say there is a desperate need for debt. This makes sense, of course, makes sense. But to say that it's not a problem in the long term misses a number of points, in my view. I mean, first, there is the economics of it, which is to say that interest rates, sure, they're low now, but they're not going to be low in the future.
That's right.
The second issue is if you use the debt to invest in the economy and create economic growth, then you can hope that your economy will grow faster than the costs of the debt in the future, and that will all be fine. Mm. But that's what they said to the, you know, the Mexicans in the 1970s and the Argentinians in the 90s. That's what they said then. And then
yikes.
They said in the first wave and in the second wave and in the third wave, and now we're in a fourth wave. If the economy is not going to grow as a consequence of this debt, then you've got a problem. And thirdly, I think that there is a sovereign security risk because it matters where you get the debt from.
Okay.
If you get the debt from the World Bank, this is an international organization, and it's subject to international rule of law, and it's subject to terms and conditions, which means it can't force a default on your economy. If you borrow the money from your friends, as in the European Union, for example, you know, the Greeks borrowed it from the Germans and the French. I don't know if the Greeks and the Germans, and they weren't particularly friendly at that time. I think they're more friendly now. But if you borrow it from your mates, then you can deal with it in a friendly and cordial way, and they're not going to force you to repay it with very little notice. But if you borrow it from a country which is not necessarily interested in those sort of things, and if they are asking for conditions in return for the debt, for example, we will give you the debt for sure, for infrastructural development in your economy, which is a great thing, but you have to contract with our companies.
Right.
And you have to give us collateral. So yes, I'm going to give you $10 billion US dollars in by way of a debt, but I need to own that port or that airport or that pipeline or something like that. Then you can see that the debt is not an unconditional debt. The debt is conditional on the ownership of strategic assets by an overseas entity. Mm. And this is one of the reasons why, for example, in Malaysia, the mega projects, you know, remember these mega projects under the Barisan government, and why people were actually quite concerned about these mega projects is because they came with heavy debt. And this debt was conditional on using particular contractors from particular country under
right.
particular circumstances. And if that becomes a very important part of your development resource, like we said, because they're not, you know, many countries around the world are not able to get access either to the World Bank or to foreign governments or to the international private financial markets. So they go to a particular country to fill the void. And if that's a consequence of passing over very important strategic national assets to that country, then that becomes a problem in the long term.
Hmm.
Okay, so we need to view debt in that way. And there is also the issue, as we mentioned before, which is if the debt becomes so burdensome on your economy that you're not able to get the growth to repay the debt, then the issue of debt forgiveness has to be on the table. If you're dealing with lenders who are open in, you know, extreme circumstances, they are open to the idea of debt forgiveness, then you have a friendly and cordial possibility of solving your debt problem. But if you're dealing with people who are not open to the prospect of debt forgiveness, then it can become a massive burden. So whilst I understand, you know, I'm not a Nobel laureate yet. So I understand these, what these Nobel laureates telling us, don't worry about debt. There is some rationale for that. But frankly, I think there is a reason to worry about debt because there are economic, social, and political issues related to global debt. And that's a big issue.
All right, Geoffrey, on that note, thank you so much for speaking with me today. That was really insightful.
It's a pleasure.
That was Geoffrey Williams, an economist at the Malaysia University of Science and Technology, talking to me about global debt. What does it actually mean, and who does the planet owe money to? So if you missed any part of this show, you can check out the podcast on the BFM app, bfm.my, or pretty much wherever you get your podcasts from. You've been listening to Today I Learned with me, Dashran Johan, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.